This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 7th of May on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next hour, we'll talk to one of the designers behind the pioneering GPS Braille maps for the blind.
You can just use the Siri function of iPhone and actually say, I want to go to point A or to point B. And then on the grid, it's actually, you can feel the road you have to walk.
We'll drop in on a historic building in Paris, about to undergo its third incarnation, from bathhouse to nightclub to hotel.
We would like to make a new address, but not a new place, because the place is here, but a new address with a new guest and a real atmosphere for people who love Paris.
And we'll be joined in the studio by Design Miami director Marianne Goebel, ahead of this year's Basel Fair.
We certainly have the ambition to be a forum for that end of the design spectrum where it's not about mass production. And I think we see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object.
Elsewhere, we'll speak to the winners of the Mies van der Rohe Prize for Architecture. We'll meet the incoming creative director of Gieves & Hawkes and find a beautiful young design studio in Madrid too. All that and plenty more on this packed edition of Section D. We begin this week's Section D in central Paris, in a building which, for a century and a half, has been iconic for a number of reasons. Number 7, Rue du Bourg l'Abbé, in the 3rd arrondissement, first opened its doors in 1885 as a high-end bain-douche, or public bathhouse, which was then transformed in the late 1970s into the legendary nightclub Les Bains. It was considered in its heyday to be one of the world's hottest night spots, regularly hosting the glitterati of the day. But the venue was suddenly shut down in 2010 after being declared structurally hazardous. Well, our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson went along to find out what's next for this much-loved building.
The sound of the latest chapter being carved out for what was the public bathhouse where Marcel Proust used to wash himself, the Paris nightclub where Grace Jones, Robert De Niro, Andy Warhol all strutted their stuff whenever they came to town, and which as of next year will be a smart new hotel on the edge of the Marais. I'm going to go inside Les Bains Douches now and meet one of the men whose job these next 12 months is to make this, the building's third major transformation, actually happen.
I'm Jean-Louis Corrible and I work with Jean-Pierre Marois, who is the owner of Les Bains. And I work with him on this project. The project is to make an hotel and a restaurant at the place where the Bain Douche was during 30 years old nightclub, who everybody know in the world. And we need to. We would like to make a new address. But not a new place, because the place is here, but a new address with a new guest and a real atmosphere for people who love Paris.
What are you going to keep in terms of the old features of the Bain Douches in the new project?
The name. The name and maybe as a spirit, but nothing more.
And what's the concept of the hotel exactly?
At this time, we don't know exactly, but we think and we hope that the new architect who makes the rooms and the hotel project made a very, very sensitive rooms with art, of course, where we'd like to stay 3 or 4 nights.
Okay, and why do you think this building is so historic and so important in Paris?
Because first, as the building was built in 1885, and it's a very historical building, and during a long time was Les Bains Douches, so it was for people who work near from here, from Les Halles, and they want to come here to be distressed, but to take some coffee or chocolate and to have some good time after a very hard night work. And also during 25-30 years. It was the high hotspot for the show business and for people who want to make fiesta in Paris.
And when will the project all be finished?
Maybe in September 2014.
So that's what's next for this building, from bathhouse to nightclub to hotel. But just before undergoing that transformation into a hotel, the building's owner, Jean-Pierre Marois, lent these 3,000 square meters to urban artists for a few months for them to live and create murals and installations, and also to experiment to their heart's content throughout this rather creaky building's 7 floors. And their works have been photographed and they'll soon be exhibited at a Paris gallery. Well, I'm going to make my way down this rather windy wooden staircase to what remains of the dance floor, where I'm going to meet Clémence Wolf, who's been helping out with that temporary gallery project.
What is so significant, Clémence, about this floor that we're on now?
The floor was made by Philippe Stack. It was his first private command. It was very strange at this time, because in the late 70s, nightclubs were more like fluo and with a lot of lights and like disco style. And Philippe Stack arrived and made this black and white, very sober floor for the discotheque.
It doesn't look either very 70s or very modern, really. It could be from the original baths.
Exactly, it doesn't look like disco or anything related to the 70s or 80s, but a very designed floor.
I'm walking through this huge room with the Philippe Stark floor that was once the dance floor of this iconic nightclub. You can almost see the ghosts of people throughout the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, all the way up until 2010, when this place ceased to be a nightclub. So we're now at what was the entrance to the baths, then the nightclub, and soon next year to be the hotel. And it's a rather haunting scene, grandeur covered in dust and all boarded up all over the place with these bits of art and graffiti that the artists who did their installations have left behind. It's quite a haunting scene, isn't it, for those of us who remember the nightclub?
Yes, it was the place where all the people had their memories here. And because we entered the place by the kitchen, the place which used to be the kitchen, it was when they arrived there, they said, oh, I remember, it was the nightclub, because it's the entrance. And on her right, it was the clock room. And it was really the place they have in memories.
Okay, we're now standing at what was once the swimming pool of the baths, a place I guess you could cool down. And it was also once a VIP room of a nightclub in its sort of 70s, 80s heyday.
Yeah, as an example, it was the place where Prince had his table when he came to the bain douche. And Thierry Ardisson used to have a TV show just in front of this swimming pool. So it's the myth and the symbol of the nightclub.
Et finalement, quand on lit les interviews que vous avez données depuis quelques années, vous êtes toujours extrêmement discrète. Je ne pas que le journaliste essayait de...
Okay, so we've come to the end of our tour now. Thank you very much, Clémence, for showing me around. It's a rather sad day, I guess, for you as well, now that this place is closing its sort of middle life in between the nightclub and the hotel phase.
Yeah, but we'll soon have a book and all the picture as a memory of this special project with this amazing artist. We will have an exhibition at the gallery in Paris. So Magdalene's gallery, the exhibition will start on June the 15th with the pictures of this project and special installation by Vils, Eyes, Latlas and Stenlex. So we will be able to enjoy it for a long time.
Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Burgess-Watson. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. After Salone, the design crowd regroups for a couple of months. The next event on the calendar takes place in June, the more glittering affair of Design Miami, hosted in Basel. Design Miami's director, Marianne Goebel, joined me in the studio whilst passing through London to give us a preview of what to expect.
Our main excitement is that we're moving to a new location. Especially in Basel, the fair has been very itinerant because this is our fourth location, actually. And we are moving in a new state-of-the-art exhibition hall designed by Herzog & Dameron.
It's a fantastic exhibition space. I haven't visited it myself, but we've done a big profile in the magazine a couple of issues ago. And I think maybe exhibition halls have been neglected in the past, just for sake of practicality in terms of using it as an exhibition space to get as much in there as possible, as easily as possible.
Yeah, or to be as neutral and versatile as possible. And I think what's so great about this hall is that it has a character.
Exactly.
It has a very strong, I would say, industrial character, which lends itself very nicely for what we want to talk about. So it's really a great move for us.
So you think this is home finally for...
Yes. We don't want to go out there.
No, fair enough. And what about in terms of exhibitors and talks, or, you know, is there a big change, or are you very much sticking to tried and tested formula that seems to be going very well?
Well, there is certainly an evolution going on, because with the new hall we also have new possibilities. So we are first of all growing our gallery program by about 20%, which now sounds very, very big, but that means that we will have 48 exhibitors, so we remain a very compact and focused fair. But thanks to this new hall, we have a marvelous additional space, some sort of monumental entrance hall, which we can use for cultural programming. And we are actually staging a design performance. So we are working with Berlin-based designer Judith Seng, who will set up something like a full production cycle, and she's working with dancers. So I think we can be prepared for something very beautiful.
Wonderful. That sounds
interesting.
Unusual. The suggestion that you are increasing the exhibiting galleries by 20% shows that, it would suggest that the industry is quite healthy at that end, compared to maybe sort of in the lower end of the market, following on from Salone, where it seems like a lot of the Italian manufacturers are in big trouble. But do you think galleries are doing a healthy business at the moment?
Yeah, we've had a very good last year. Both the Basel and Miami Fair in 2012 have been commercially successful. And again, we're focusing. So it's 48 exhibitors which have been handpicked by our selection committee. And these are all galleries who have a very strong program. I mean, they are determined to promote the designers that they have been working with, be it historic or contemporary designers. And I think if you follow a coherent program, you build up somebody over years and years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that point on curation is very interesting, because a few weeks ago we were all in Milan for Salone, and it's such a huge beast that you don't really know where to begin. And you mentioned before we came on that you've been 15 times, is it?
Yeah, I feel like a veteran. It's been my 15th year.
I know, I felt like I've know it very well indeed, and it doesn't get any easier. And I came away from it this year thinking, that does it still really make sense to have this, on the one hand, enormous global furniture market, together with this platform for discussion about the future of the industry, which, having them exist in the same city and a lot of the same spaces, still sort of seems like you're talking about the end of one industry, and then at the other end of the room you're still showing 10 sofas. Do you think Design Miami could in the future fulfill the role that, you know, is a small platform where the future of the design industry really does get discussed and properly sort of solutions maybe are found?
I would certainly have the ambition to be a forum for that end of the design spectrum, where it's not about mass production. And I think we see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world. And I think also design industry is a very, obviously a very important player in this market. And I hope that it will actually get better soon again. When we're looking at this other end of the spectrum, and we want to give these designers a platform being in the gallery program, but also in the talks in our Designers of the Future Award, where we deliberately look beyond the mere furniture product design or initiatives like design performance that we're staging this year. So we're definitely hosting the designers who pursue this different approach.
And I think in terms of the enjoyment of the event, which is actually so crucial for people who travel, and I think, well, certainly to Basel, certainly to Miami, obviously two locations where it's quite easy to have fun. In Milan, which should be a complete celebration of the city as well, it's so big and so sort of badly edited, I would say, that sort of the human experience of being there seems to have been neglected somewhere along the line. How much time and energy and effort and thought do you put into sort of the experience, say, not just of the journalists, obviously, but of the buyers, crucially, when they come to Basel or when they go to Miami?
Well, a lot. For us, it's is, as you say, all about the experience of our guests at the fair, but also in the city as such. So I don't know if you've been on our website recently, but we've also done a little portal about where to go in Basel or where to go in Miami, where we pick our favorite museums, restaurants, or just places to go. But it's also about collaborating with local institutions, making sure that we offer tours also with our museum partners, or things like, I don't know, Miami last year. There's an amazing stadium, it's a marine stadium from the 1960s facing the bay, which is, it's actually about to fall apart. So there's an initiative of people who are trying to save the stadium. So we organize a tour of the stadium. So things like that, that give access to very unique places that you might not come across as a normal tourist.
The location, and give something back to the location as well, rather than just being this sort of mobile group of exhibitors, collectors flying from one city to another every few weeks.
No, exactly. We hope that we can embrace the local communities as well as these international communities who just come for a week.
Marianne Goebel, Director of Design Miami, talking to me in the studio there. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D. We'll be finding out about maps for the blind after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Current navigation aids for the visually impaired rely on audio commands. But the problem is that these rob the users of an important sense which they need when trying to navigate in a city. Three designers working on a 36-hour project at the Copenhagen Institute for Interactive Design have come up with an alternative solution, something they call blind maps. It's a device which plugs into a smartphone and allows the visually impaired user to literally feel their way around town using an active GPS-linked braille map. Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth met with one of the designers, Dutchman Ruben van der Vleuten, who explained how the device works and what their next step will be to take it to production.
When visually impaired, you build confidence by knowing your route well.
Bring me to the closest ATM.
Okay, everything checks out.
The concept is actually called Blind Maps, and it's an iPhone accessory. And it's actually made to help visually impaired people to navigate through cities. Because actually there's nothing really there for blind people to navigate using GPS.
It's a kind of small matchbox size thing that sticks in the bottom of a smartphone or an iPhone, right?
No, exactly. It's just a small iPhone accessory, and you can click it into your phone, and it makes use of the already existing functionalities of the iPhone. Because, well, most people do have an iPhone, otherwise it's easy to get. And an iPhone already has GPS functionality, it has voice recognitioning, and we want to make use of those functionalities already existing to communicate with the device.
And so the person who's using it feels with their fingers a kind of braille topographical map of where they are, and it kind of explain how it works exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually just a small grid of pixels, which work as a Braille screen, actually, so the small points can come up and go down like a
pixel. They're like physical pixels. Yeah,
yeah, physical pixels, actually. And what they can do, as soon as a person wants to navigate to a place, he can just use the Siri function of iPhone and actually say, I want to go to point A or to point B. And then on the grid, it actually, you can feel the road you have to walk. So in the first stage, it displays the whole map, the route. And then with your thumb, you can keep it on, and then it actually displays the next step. So from corner A to corner B, and you actually can feel where you have to go without actually using your ears or other senses.
How did you come to that solution? What was the process?
Well, it was part of a design course at CIID in Copenhagen, and we were with a group of three people, two other people, Andrew Spitz and Markus Schmeidlich. And it was a really short, intense course. We only had 2 days to come up with the whole concept. And since we didn't have that much time to do the whole user research, we tried to base it on experience we already had. And Markus Schmeidlich worked already with visually impaired people. And that was actually our input. So we used his experience to actually come up with the whole concept and try to imagine what would be useful for people who are visually impaired.
It allows you to be aware of upcoming intersections, turns, and hazards en route. Wearing headphones and listening to a voice can be a dangerous distraction. With voice guidance, there is no practical way to get real-time and continuous feedback on your progress.
What's the biggest challenge? I guess that if you're trying to guide a visually impaired person, they've got to be able to trust 100%. And, for example, Apple's GPS system has had a few problems, right? Is that a concern?
Of course, that's a concern. There are two things that are actually really important. First of all, when you navigate through a city, when you're visually impaired, you have one sense less, so you don't want to, you really have to rely on your ears, actually. And what most navigation systems do at the moment is they use your auditory senses to navigate you, but as a visually impaired, you want to use that and keep it optimized. So that was one big thing, and that's how we came to the tactile thing instead of auditory feedback. So that was one big thing. The other big thing is, of course, the navigation through a city based on GPS. As we all know, GPS is not super reliable all the time. And
there are a lot of canals in Copenhagen. That's what I'm worried about.
No, exactly. That's the biggest concern we have at the moment. But another concern is as well the navigation if maybe a street is broken up due to construction. And that's why we included a crowdsource aspect to it as well. Because if a street is blocked, for instance, a person can just simply hit a button that it's blocked, and then it's taken into the system. And the next time somebody else or yourself is navigated through that street, it actually avoids all those points. So it's also based on crowdsourcing.
So you're going to rely on the inhabitants of a city to keep you updated?
No, exactly. So the more people use it, the more reliable it actually gets.
The device is constantly sending feedback on the way the user is navigating in the space. If the walk is irregular and with lots of stops, sudden movements, and change of direction, the service will intelligently rate the route.
And what's the next step with the project? Because it's in a dummy form right now. It was part of a project you were working on. I understand that there is a company that's maybe interested in taking it further.
No, exactly. That's at the moment we're talking with a company who are doing Braille technology, and we're looking into actually realizing it. But it will be a long way to get from where we are now to actually a functional model. But that's now we're researching into the possibilities of making it work.
So that company is coming with funding, or you're having to find your own co-funding, or how does that work?
Well, that's what we're looking into now, how we get the thing funded. We're looking for some co-funding and maybe even crowdsource funding, like Kickstarter could be interested in.
How much are you looking for?
Well, we'll be a couple hundred thousand euros. I don't know exactly in kronas, but a couple hundred thousand euros.
And then, assuming you get that money, what would the next stage be, and how long would the development process be, do you think?
Well, first of all, the most important thing is get a functional prototype to get the technology working with the whole Braille display. And then the next thing is to make it reliable. As you said, it has to be reliable for visually impaired. It has to work all the time, and you cannot say, okay, sometimes it doesn't work, and then let people figure it out themselves.
Yeah, I guess their lives are in your hands with this machine, right?
Exactly, literally, yeah.
When you reach your destination and the route was safe, you can press the OK button.
D- designer Ruben van der Vluten, with our Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth there. Now, this week, for our regular nose around the workspace of a designer, we went off to the studio of Fernando Giorgi, who designs a line of fine jewellery that seeks inspiration from his native Brazil. In his studio, tucked away in London's Shoreditch, Giorgi told us why he decided to branch away from London's traditional jewellery quarter and told us what music he listens to set the tone for a day's work.
It's a studio office, it's not a workshop, so the jewellery isn't made here. I come here every morning, late morning, because still I don't have too much stuff, so I can really be free with my time. And I feel like I'm much more productive as the day goes on. So I arrive around 11 and then do the emails. And every day there's different things going on. So sometimes I have people coming over to see jewelry. Sometimes I have to leave and go to the workshops and research things. But ideally, my creative day would start with, getting rid of the bureaucratic part of the day. And then in the afternoon, just designing and following up things and focusing on that. I was looking for somewhere that, there's the jewelry community in Hatton Garden, but it's pretty much, it's very jewelry oriented, a little bit overwhelming. And then I was looking for a place that wasn't as far and it was closer in between, where I live and where I have to go a lot, which is Hatton Garden or central London sometimes. And I was looking for studios that had some charm, English charm. So I was in London. I would imagine in the beginning that I would have some clients coming over or just something to be comfortable with having people over. And then I found this space and I had no hesitation. You can see there's a lot of natural light. I think this used to be a glass workshops. Officially, I didn't research very deeply, but it's called Sunbury Glass Works. And then the half of the ceiling is glass, which is now with this weather is amazing, but during the winter it can get harsh. But there's also a fireplace, which was really convincing that I would put up with the cold from here. So I did use the fire quite a few times with this long winter. But I'm hoping, to give it a rest now. Music is really important in the studio. There's always something going on. Sometimes it's just the radio on. I think the process is either the mood sets the music choices or you just don't know what to play. You just play something and then the music will set the mood. But the mood here has to be relaxed. I think a beat is more interesting than having something really melodic that you can't talk and be interrupted. And I think everyone here likes to eventually start singing along, so we play a lot of Brazilian music. Especially we go through phases, and now this phase of changing, spring coming, it's been celebrating sunshine and being uplifting music. So I play a lot of Brazilian music, Jorge Ben. We went to this Brazilian party, me and my sister, it's like a jewelry celebration in Paris. And then we came back, and since then we've just been playing Jorge Ben again and again, and like being nostalgic about Brazil, but really happy about being in London with the summer coming. Eu só quero que Deus me ajude e o menino muito mais também. Pois a rosa é uma flor, a flor é uma rosa, o menino não é ninguém. Olha o menino, ui, ui, ui. Olha o menino. That was Frases by Giorgi Bain there. Still to come, we'll be talking to Jason Basmajian, the new creative director for Gives and Hawks, and we'll be talking to the winning architect of this year's Mies van der Rohe Prize too. But it's time now to go shopping. This time we're heading to Madrid, and more precisely the city's famed La Latina district, home to Europe's largest outdoor market and a veritable treasure trove of vintage furniture stores. But amidst all the antiques and bric-a-brac, a small studio and designer furniture and accessory shop stands out. It's Espacio Brut. Our correspondent Liam Aldous paid a visit to the two owners, Jose and Brolio, who were both hard at work designing their new range.
I think it could be a nice surprise to find us or to find our store, because We are a store, we are an art gallery. We promote young artists and we show them here too. And I think it would be a surprise.
People are surprised. After seeing all the other stores with so much repetition in furniture and objects, they come here and they see something out of the ordinary, fresh and natural, and above all, different. We are interior designers. We also offer a service where we alter things in people's houses, their daily lives, or simply something that's getting in the way, taking a different approach to what they're used to. They might come with a preconceived idea for a vintage or retro table and then change their mind completely after seeing our work and what we do.
Espacio Brut first opened its doors in 2009. A short walk from the iconic strip known as El Rastro, owners Jose and Braulio believe firmly in the power of design to improve lives, and their functional and often playful furniture designs reflect this spirit everywhere I look.
We can start with, for example, this pair of chairs. It's one of our first designs, and their function is like chairs or like book stands, like in a sculpture. It has references based on the 20th century architectures of European or North European masters.
It's actually perfect to store books, but also magazines, which a lot of our readers would like.
Yes. We have an atelier with several people, two, three persons that make and manufacture our pieces by hand. Mainly we use birch plywood, and we normally offer different finishes like lacquered, varnished, oiled, etc. We use two, massive oak and poplar. Our references from the 20th century, like Alvar Aalto perhaps, that's a Finnish architect, Danish too, and German and Americans and English too.
Apart from your wonderful furniture line, you also have a broad range of other products as well from well-known designers. What have we got on these well-laden shelves in front of us?
We like Martin Margiela and his 13 line, La Ligne 13. For example, this it's a white matryoshka made by hand. It is an icon of our time, I think.
The completely blank white babushkas?
Yeah, white is the characteristic of Margiela in his fashion, in his line of home objects and decoration. These blankets that are for the new collection of Eleanor Pritchard that we like very much, they are made in traditional twill in Wales. Perhaps we can choose a Savoy base that was a very famous Finnish architect. And he designed this base to a restaurant in the 30s in Helsinki. It is an icon too.
How would you describe the designer furniture market in Madrid? Is it big? Is it just a niche market? Has it changed?
Madrid has not a solid tradition because Madrid has been always the capital city, and as a capital city, it has been service, commerce, tourist, financial city, etc. And people in Madrid has been always very traditional, very classical in his taste. So the outlook, it is not easy for the designers who live in Madrid. Some designers go out to develop his work out of Spain, like Jaime Ayón, for example. Anyways, there is an important group of designers working in Madrid. We can't forget this is a big city, too.
Has it changed? Do you think there's kind of a new movement in Madrid, perhaps a thirst for difference amongst the people?
I think so, and I think it's very authentic. It's very local, but very authentic. It has its own personality. I think so, yeah.
That was Jose and Braulio of Espacio Brut with our Liam Aldous in Madrid there. You're listening to Section D.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. British bespoke tailors Gives and Hawkes have been making fine menswear for over 200 years. Their standalone store at No. 1 Savile Row is a well-known stop for gents on the lookout for quality-made formal wear. Since January, in charge of the label's aesthetic is creative director Jason Basmajian, who joined the company after 6 years at Italian menswear brand Brioni. Our associate editor Nelly Gotcheva met Basmajian in Gieves & Hawkes offices in Hanover Square to learn more about the company's future plans and the new fall-winter collection, which will be Basmajian's first for the label.
I arrived end of January, so essentially when you come in at that, it's the beginning of what would be the next spring season. So we should have actually been working on spring. I arrived and found the product and collection not as inspired as it should be, and I felt that if we didn't get going and change fall right away, we would be a year before new product and new collections were in our retail network, which I felt a shame because none of us here on the team really like to sit still. We're quite busy and we take on a lot, and we really want to move the brand forward. It's a very exciting project. So I got together with my team, who are fantastic, and I said, you know, guys, why not tackle fall? And they sort of looked at me like, you know, we're going to redo an entire collection. I said, we're going to redo an entire collection and launch a capsule collection, because I wanted there to be a link between bespoke, which is what our heritage comes from at No. 1 Savile Row, and ready to wear. And I said, not only will we redo mainline collection, but let's launch a made in England, hand tailored with British fabrics as a kind of capsule. So everybody was really excited and motivated, and we just got to it and we started from scratch and put together two lovely collections, redid blocks, worked with our pattern makers on Savile Row, worked with the tailors, worked with our valued fabric suppliers, bringing in back a lot of the British feel. I want to very much keep a British accent, but the collection needs to obviously go much more international. So doing that through whether it's using beautiful tweeds, but in lighter weights, whether it was developing vintage-inspired fabrics from our archive, from the military with British mills in Huddersfield to get the kind of look that we wanted, but to give it a much more comfortable and modern and lighter weight application. So it's all very tailoring based. We are obviously No. 1 Savile Row, so I think this brand has to come off, no pun intended, it has to hang off a tailoring inspiration, whether we're doing luxury sportswear or suits. So we started with fall. We really put together the idea we wanted this collection to have the feel of sort of town and country. So there was both the sort of tweedy gentleman aspects, but quite modern in perspective and silhouette, and then a very urban suiting aspect. Which was, I think, what we did in a very short amount of time was exciting, and bringing in very rich colors inspired by the British countryside and Scottish woolens and cashmeres. The fact that we could launch Royal Line, which is this made in England product, with very old British manufacturers, where everything's cut by hand, made by hand, tailored by hand, hand on buttonholes, full canvas construction, was great. It was very exciting to be able to put royal warrants on garments made in England from English fabrics.
And speaking of this, who do you create for?
I think that's a very relevant question, obviously, at this moment in time, because this brand has been bought. We have an entire new management team. I think what we strive to is to continue to service and provide for our existing clientele base. And it's difficult to give you a real demographic because we have clients between 25 and 75 years old. I think what our clients all have in common is sort of a commitment to quality and to style, beautiful fabrics, beautiful fit, beautiful detailing. They sort of think of all of our clients as sort of modern gentlemen. And I think that whether they need an outerwear piece, a knitwear piece, a business suit, or a special occasion suit for their wedding, or an evening wear tuxedo, there is a kind of interest in what is actually stylish over what's fashion. And there's a certain amount of timelessness and elegance that goes with that. So we are absolutely designing for our existing customer, but we have taken the collection and the inspiration a little bit younger. And I think at the end of the day, regardless of age, who doesn't want to feel younger and thinner and better looking, you know, in the way they dress? I don't think men are so different from women in that way. And also keeping in mind that our man comes into the store to build on his wardrobe. He's not changing his wardrobe every season. He's not a victim to trend. I mean, he's certainly looking for things that are fresh and new, but it's always about building on what he has and providing him the clothes and the service that he needs and that he's looking for.
And you just mentioned your store. And I know that there are some developments happening there. So can you just tell us more about this?
I mean, we have a beautiful flagship at number one Savile Row, which is obviously a historical building. It was a William Kent designed building. And the back of the building was the former home of the Royal Geographical Society. So incredible provenance and incredible history, which can also weigh heavy at some times as well in terms of moving a brand forward. So an incredibly rich archive, which we house there, which is open to the public. So we always welcome people to visit. We've dressed incredible statesmen and royalty and politicians and businessmen and celebrities through the years. You can't really create 240 years of a story. What I'm saying is the brand has incredible authenticity and creates integrity. So with Savile Row, we felt it was time that it needs a facelift. It's a beautiful building. The building's being restored at the moment on the external, and we wanted the shop to have a much easier, lighter feel in terms of the interiors. And so we're working with a London-based designer, somebody who specializes more in residential architecture and interiors versus shop fit, and creating really an ultimate shopping experience for the gentleman, which would be, he would be able to come in and really spend a Saturday afternoon, have a coffee at the bar, do a made-to-measure suit, have a bespoke experience if that's what he wanted, with our bespoke cutters on hand. We'll have a private VIP bespoke room, which is very club-like in atmosphere. I think the journey through the store is very much inspired by the journey through a man's wardrobe. So you sort of go through the store discovering different parts, whether it's the accessories or formal wear or day wear or sports wear, casual wear. So we're really excited about the store, bringing in lots of new materials, lots of oak floor and light colored walls, and using a lot of traditional, also British artisans to create. So some of the railings and fixtures are going to be created all by small independent ateliers in England, furniture as well. So using as much made in England and England products, products from England that we can, which we think speaks to the heritage of the brand.
And we kind of covered local ground. I know that you recently came back from Hong Kong. Can you tell me more about your international markets?
Absolutely. So the brand was actually purchased, as I mentioned, by Trinity, which is a Hong Kong-based group. They had been developing the brand in Asia. We have almost 120 stores in China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Very strong. It's a very prestigious brand in Asia. We have a handful of stores here still in the UK, and we're looking towards obviously expanding the business internationally. I think in terms of also the collection, it's why we need to sort of look at the collection as keeping a British accent but having an international application and style. So there's a lot of movement forward on developing the business internationally. We'd love to go into markets eventually like the United States and the Middle East and develop more in Europe. But it is something that the shareholders believe we should do quite slowly and cautiously in terms of really getting the brand right at home and really having it mean something. This should be really, this should be organic growth and meaningful growth. And I think also there is something to be said about a brand. Not every brand needs to be a $5 billion brand. It also can be a very beautiful, profitable brand with limited and exclusive distribution that is still accessible, but yet still keeps some of its authenticity.
That was Jason Basmajian, Creative Director of Gives and Hawks, with our Nelly Gotcheva there. Now, out of all the world's buildings, designing a concert hall is perhaps one of the toughest jobs an architect could be presented with. Not only does it have to be beautiful, its acoustics have to be spot on for every listener in every seat, whether they're listening to Bjork or Bach. And for every brilliant space, there are dozens of venues that the world's top performers do their damnedest to avoid. The Harper Concert Hall in Reykjavik is not on that list. It's just won the most prestigious accolade in European architecture, the biannual Mies van der Rohe Award. For starters, it's beautiful. Its location has helped transform Reykjavik Harbour and integrated it more closely with the rest of the capital. And it opened in the teeth of recession too. Osbjørn Jacobsen is an architect and associate partner at Henning Larsen Architects, one of the firms behind the Harper Concert Hall, and he spoke to Emma Nelson about the building's significance and the award too.
Yeah, it's of course extremely complex, but luckily we had a really great team with American acoustic engineers from Artek New York, which of course have been building halls all over, both in Asia and the States, of course, and Europe. So they a close cooperation with Arctic and us made it possible somehow to make a quite a unique hole in our mind. Also, after these 2 years of since opening, I think purely positive reactions on the acoustic performance in the hole. So, and that is somehow the fundament for the success somehow, that the instrument is working somehow. So we have, of course, been building a lot of success on top of the performance of the hole. So it has been quite a struggle, of course, and extremely complex, but somehow the combination in the team and the struggle has been worth it and brought us to the state that even the hole in Gramophone last year, it was stated as one of the 10 best holes in the world. So we are, of course, extremely happy.
Not only was it an architectural struggle, though, the hole is a product of an original plan that I believe was cancelled, and then it was amended and then put on hold because of the financial crisis. And of course, this building went up in the middle of a time when Iceland was just falling to pieces. How did the project change as time went on?
Yeah, it has been quite a journey. I myself have been on the project as a leading architect since the first sketches in 2004 in the competition. And in 2008, I moved from Copenhagen to Reykjavik to follow the project closely with my family and everything. And just 4 days after landing in Iceland, the bank sector collapsed. So to me, it was...
I bet your family were pleased about that.
No, yeah, they were happy to come to Iceland, but the situation changed dramatically just a week after we landed. And just a month later, the building site was closed down for 2 months. While they reinvested and found a new way of constructing the companies behind the project goal, because all the private investors that were involved, they were bankrupt, so to say. So it was quite a journey looking back, but it was an extremely brave decision made by the government of Iceland and the city of Reykjavik, since they stepped in and took over the project and refinanced it. At the same time, with the left hand, they were closing a couple of hospitals and schools. So it was not a popular decision at that point to invest in culture and closing hospitals. But somehow that has been also the success of the building.
That was Osbjørn Jacobsen, associate partner at Henning Larsen Architects, there talking to Emma Nelson. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. This week's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Alid at awj@monocle.com for any story ideas you might have for future episodes. Fear not, we'll be back next week with another packed show, including a rundown of New York's Pratt Institute graduate show, plus much more besides. All that remains from me is to bid you farewell and leave you with a song. Here's Brooklyn band Miss Mister with Hurricane. Goodbye.
Welcome to the inner workings of my